This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai whakarongo mai ki te ao tai whenua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round. Well, we get out and about a lot on Country Life, and this week I've been around the centre of the North Island, and that's the Tongariro River you can hear rushing along behind me. It's still high and swift after all the rain we've had this week right around the country. I'll be bringing you stories from the volcanic plateau in the next few weeks, but this week Cosmo's in Ashburton, finding out what farmers are paying at the moment for a good sheep or cattle dog. We talk to a rural GP about the stresses she and her colleagues are under at the moment, and we're also at a dahlia farm, hearing how one woman's self-confessed addiction to these brilliant coloured flowers has bloomed into a thriving little business. But first, to conditions on the land, and here it's been as wet and wintry as everywhere else. Back to the studio now, and here's Duncan Smith.
Kia ora. In Northland, deer, beef and sheep farmers are dealing with sodden ground and surface water up to 7 centimetres high. This means hungry cattle are stomping through good grass and turning it into boggy paddocks. There's concern grass won't spring back and just die. A Bay of Islands farmer is into the second week of lambing in sodden conditions. He's relieved the northerly wind isn't extremely cold, as many of his Wiltshire ewes are dropping twins. That rain is keeping farms wet underfoot throughout the Waikato region. Calving's underway, and at the same time the demand and price for silage, palm kernel and maize has risen. Many farmers used a lot of their own feed during the drought and are still a bit behind with regard to their pasture cover, so have been burning through feed supplies. Some need to buy in more feed than usual, which is putting pressure on supply companies to keep up.
In King Country, it's been time to do a bit of maintenance on boundary fences. Some farmers are vaccinating ewes before lambing next month, and they're in good condition. There's been a couple of weeks of steady rain and plenty of grass growing in mild weather, which is unusual for this time of the year. There have been several slips on Tomaranui hillsides, probably due to the constant rain after a pretty dry summer and autumn. Over in Taranaki, it's been wet too, so cows are being kept off grass as much as possible to give it time to grow. The girls are getting a top-up of silage, seaweed and maize. Dairy farmers have welcomed half a dozen young farmhands from Ireland and several others from the Philippines. This is the first time since COVID struck that international apprentices have been in the region to help and learn about milking and calving.
Kiwi fruit pruning in the Bay of Plenty is running rather late thanks to the wet weather. An orchardist says they've started on the gold kiwi fruit and anticipate moving on to the green variety in a month or so. There's just enough labour to go around, but they come at a price. Pruners are earning, on average, up to 15% more per hour compared to last year. RSE, recognised seasonal employer workers from the Pacific Islands, are filling many of the gaps. On the east coast, fewer pine forests are being felled as international lumber prices have dropped considerably. At the same time, fuel prices have shot up, hence forestry owners are leaving trees to grow for longer while they consider their options. The soggy soil around Gisborne is taking its toll on lettuce and broccoli production. Farmers are also becoming a little frustrated with muddy paddocks as their tractors are getting bogged down.
In Hawke's Bay, farms that started lambing last month are looking forward to good prices at the sales before Christmas. Paddocks are also in good shape for stock, with above-average pasture growth. That's in stark contrast to the previous couple of years, when droughts lasting well into autumn led to an extreme shortage of feed. The outbreak of bovine TB a couple of years ago near the Napier-Taupo Road continues to be contained, and there aren't any reports of it spreading further. All the rains come as a bit of a shock for many in the Manawatu region. A local from Fielding says they've had two pretty mild winters, but this week's drenching is the complete opposite. Farms are well prepared, with cattle and sheep in good condition, but paddocks are muddy and feed is being munched through. Cows are now calving, which adds to the mix of winter concerns. Farmers are optimistic about meat prices, but are keeping an eye on several freezing works they use, as there's concern if COVID returns with a vengeance, there may be delays for processing culled stock and even lambs later in the year.
In the Wairarapa, it's been about survival, as up to 100 millimetres of rain pelted parts of the region on Tuesday. Farmers have been spending the week moving cattle and sheep to higher paddocks as floodwaters crept up. One farmer said the water went over the top of some fences, and this weekend's job is clearing the debris off the wires and fence posts. It's been too wet to feed out in lower pastures for some, and a close eye has been kept on cows about to start calving. Despite the flooding worries, farmers say they were warned about the weather and acted accordingly to prevent stock losses. Across Cook Strait, Nelson pastures were described as paddy fields, as more than 80 millimetres of rain fell, and that was 2 days after an earlier dump of 30 mils. Local rivers overflowed, but drains were pretty clear, so more extensive flooding was avoided. Supplies of baleage are in demand as the heavy rain takes its toll on crops and grass. A few early lambs have started arriving, and the sun peeked through later in the week for them.
Like most of the country, Marlborough's also had plenty of surface flooding, but it didn't last and drained away fairly quickly. Vineyards are busy pruning Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Gris varieties and then wrapping the vines around the wires. It's taking longer for contract gangs to prune this season, as there've been a lot of down days due to rain. A West Coast farmer says there was a bit of wind and rain earlier in the week, but nothing they don't usually expect. Power was out in Buller and in a few other areas for a period of time. A farmer near Hokitika says the coast escaped the harsh weather pretty lightly compared to many others. An impressive amount of snow can be seen on Aoraki Mount Cook.
Canterbury's had a very wet start to the week, with about 75 millimetres falling onto already sodden ground on the plains on Tuesday. Our contact says this caused some localised flooding on the day, but by Wednesday morning the water was mostly gone. Very little damage was reported. Snow fell in the foothills, which everyone was well prepared for. Further down south in Otago's Balclutha, the weather has been described as reasonably mild, with temperatures getting down to about 5 degrees overnight. Farmers appreciated the rainfall of about 42 millimetres this week, saying they needed a decent drop. Still, there are plenty of puddles, and winter crops such as fodder beets and swedes are lasting well for stock. Some farmers have been busy scanning their ewes for lamb numbers prior to lambing in September. Finally, for Southland, the last week is being described as business as usual. There have been a few flooded creeks, but no major problems. Many cattle are on winter crops and being fed out to each day. Farmers say they missed the worst of this week's bad weather, and some early lambs are already skipping around paddocks.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Authorities are seeking to reassure farmers about the threat of foot and mouth disease for New Zealand livestock. On last week's show, we spoke to Ross Ainsworth, who's a vet based in Bali, and he warned that tourists were swarming back to the island just as the disease, which can devastate herds, had been confirmed there. There's a danger of visitors mixing with cattle and pigs there as they freely wander between grazing spots, often past areas where tourists stay, and vaccination doses have been slow getting to the island. Vaccines can protect cattle from foot and mouth, but they're tricky to roll out. The virus has a number of strains, and the vaccine needs to match the strain that is circulating in order to be effective. Biosecurity New Zealand's Deputy Director General, Stuart Anderson, says here in New Zealand, vaccines could be rolled out within days.
Vaccines are one part of the toolkit in terms of if we had to deal with foot and mouth disease. So we do have arrangements in place and vaccines available for New Zealand if we ever had to deal with it. We have 5,000 odd doses of vaccine covering 9 main strains of foot and mouth disease in the UK in a vaccine bank, which are available for our exclusive use. And they can rapidly ramp up and manufacture more if we were to need them.
How long would it take to get the vaccines here?
They would be here within a matter of days, and also within a matter of days they would be manufacturing further doses for us. We also arrangements with other countries to share vaccines. So that's Australia, Canada, UK, US and Ireland. We are countries that actively work to keep foot and mouth disease out, and we have an arrangement in place that if any of our countries needed vaccine, we would also support each other by allocating some of our doses to each other.
Say it did get to Australia, would you look at ramping up your order or getting it over just to be ready with it, or?
Yeah, look, so, I mean, if it got into Australia, obviously, you know, that would be a major new significant development for us, a lot closer, and would heighten the risk dramatically. We are, at the moment, in any case, you know, we're talking with Australians, you know, certainly a few times a week at least, in terms of this situation. We would have to determine where in Australia, what did the risk look like. Australia would obviously, you know, deploy their vaccines, and we would decide whether we needed to, you know, do anything different in terms of vaccine availability. But they're all available, and when they're needed, we can rapidly get them in the country.
Stuart Anderson says the overall risk to New Zealand from the Indonesian outbreak is still low, but officials are keeping a close eye on it.
Rural GPs are among the 900 doctors demanding the government face up to what they're calling a catastrophic collapse of the health workforce. Anthea Prentice has a sole doctor practice in Cheviot, just over 100 kilometres north of Christchurch. She has an enrolled patient base of about 1,300, a receptionist, 3 part-time nurses and a practice manager. Dr. Prentice has been a GP for 30 years. And Susan Murray caught up with her during the week and started by asking a good doctor question. How are you feeling?
There definitely is stress amongst the rural workforce, for sure. It's been coming for a long time, and I think the pandemic has certainly highlighted it, but it's been in place for quite some years, and there's been a little bit of delay possibly in recognising it by the ministry. In Cheviot, we're lucky because I live in the district, so I've been available throughout my working life to work in Cheviot, and it's certainly been my priority to work in Cheviot. And we, at the moment, also have 2 doctors who are also long-standing rural doctors in our Purunui community, but they are nearing the end of their working life. They're both over 70, and so I'm not sure what will happen in the nearest future when they won't be available to pick up the extra days.
How do you feel, though, when you hear Minister Littles just not quite coming out over the line and saying there's a crisis? He admits there's an issue and that they're trying to deal with it, but he just won't use that word crisis. How does that make you feel?
I think that's politicians for you, isn't it? I mean, they never want to admit there's a crisis. I do think that in more recent years, general practice and rural general practice in particular has been very much the poor cousin of the secondary care that happens in hospitals. The money is funneled in through the secondary care much more than into the primary, and it's actually developed quite a disparity of the pay that's happening for the medical workforce that work in the community as opposed to the medical workforce that works in the hospital. So I think he is probably just choosing his words very carefully, as politicians do, but I'm sure at that level and in the ministry there's some acceptance and recognition that we are at a breaking point. And I think the pandemic has just been the extra straw that's broken the camel's back, probably, or exposed the stresses that the workforce is under.
Just quickly, looking at the disparity, say, with pay, in a very general term, can you tell me what, say, a hospital doctor would get compared with a rural GP with not a huge client base, but a very busy one nonetheless?
I'm not 100% sure, sorry, Susan, about the actual figures, but there's not only money involved, it's also work conditions. I know in the hospital there's quite a lot of provision for conference leave and peer review and opportunities within the team to support one another. When you're a rural solo practitioner who you're having to find locum cover for any time that you have off for family or recreation, you know, training, keeping yourself skilled and safe, that has to come out of your own pocket. And there's also a sense that possibly, as a country perhaps, general practice has been undervalued, and there's a sense of, oh, you're just a GP, and yet that is the foundation of our system, that we're the first port of call for every medical and health interaction, and yet we're often thought of at the last minute by the powers that be in the ministry. So that adds to the stress, definitely.
How is this crisis and the stress expressing itself for you as a person, as a GP? And what is a typical day?
We did have to keep on our toes as far as the instructions that came down from the ministry. Pivoting seemed to be the order of the day, trying to keep up with all the changes, and the stress from that actually did take its toll. I think it's made me realise that I do have to prioritise my family and my own time so that I don't want to burn out, because I do love my job. I think I will from now on probably stick to my normal hours and try not to overburden myself with too much extra work.
If we looked at the rural GP network in the broader sense, that catastrophic collapse, does that apply for a lot of rural areas, would you say? To what extent does that apply?
I definitely think that's correct. The situation for rural general practice is dire, and there's big areas that aren't covered by GPs, or there's long waits to see a GP. The more vulnerable areas of our country are underserviced, and so that leads to much higher need for secondary services down the track. So it's actually, this is one of the main complaints really about the system, is that it focuses more on the secondary care, whereas if we could get the primary care right across the country working as well as it could be, it would really take some of the burden from secondary care. The way a lot of those rural practices are run now is with a series of locums. With the best of intentions, can't provide that same level of continuity, and sometimes really just fighting the fires at the top, the things that have got really serious, and doing the emergency, urgent stuff, and not doing the grassroots incremental changes that do make the difference in the end between or good health outcomes and poor health outcomes. In addition to that, there's no public transport. There's no way for people to get to their appointments in Christchurch, so they often miss them. The diesel, petrol is so expensive now. Everything is centralised in the big metropolitan areas, when really we need to be pushing some of those services out into the more rural areas where the demand is, which will make it easier for people to access them. You know, 1 million people live in rural New Zealand. All our politicians and all the health ministry should be looking at developing policies looking through the rural lens. You know, it's all about equity, isn't it? Equity of care. And someone who lives in the country should expect to get just as good health care as someone who lives in a city. So some of it is that no one comes out here to see what's actually happening. And there's been a big, and you know, it can be a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Rural general practice is difficult and understaffed, and so people think, well, why would I go there when I can get a practice in a city which is potentially easier, maybe more lucrative? We can be a victim of our own PR in a way.
We've got the Health Minister Andrew Little sitting in front of us, and you've got an open checkbook. Anthea, what are you going to say to him?
It has to start at med school. We need to be getting all our medical students out into the community. They do general practice as part of their study and as an undergraduate, but it's only a short time, and it would be good for them to see what we can achieve, what we do, and how varied it is and how interesting. Plus, because when you're in the hospital and do all your training in the hospital, that's where you see medical medicine should be done. You know, you don't experience the general practice in the community, so you don't you don't understand what can be done and what can be achieved out there. I am an optimist, and I hope that other people will get to enjoy the rural life that I've enjoyed. And we sort of didn't touch on the ageing workforce, but everybody's getting older, and I'm not sure I'll be doing it till I'm 70, like my colleagues.
It was rural GP Anthea Prentice talking to Susan Murray.
The Health Minister, Andrew Little, says he hears the concerns of frontline staff and acknowledged the really tough winter after 2 years of pandemic. He says the government is continuing to work to fill staffing gaps.
Now we're heading to Mid-Canterbury with Cosmo to find out what hard-working farm dogs are worth and who is buying and selling them.
I am at the Mayfield AMP showgrounds, and this is where a farm dog sale is about to happen. And to find out more, I am with auctioneer Greg Cook from PGG Wrightsons.
What's the 66th annual Ashburton dog sale, sheep and cattle dog sale, which has been moved to Mayfield the last 6 years ago. So it's been held up there since. We're offering today about 45 Hunter-Wayne heading dogs. Sheep and cattle dogs, yeah.
Mm. Are you expecting a good turnout?
Yeah. No, we always get a pretty good crowd. I'd like to think that we could have 50, 60 registered buyers. There's always good demand for good dogs, so it seems to be less people training them today, so people are prepared to come out and pay good money to buy a good dog.
How far afield are people coming from to attend the auction?
Last couple of years, they've come from all over the South Island and the North Island as well. We get quite a few North Island buyers. I don't know if we've got any coming down this year or not, but in the past years, we've had North Island buyers come down as well. We've got dogs down from the North Island today as well. So,
yes. And are these dogs that have had a lot of experience on farms, or are they younger ones that need to be trained?
Most of them are all trained. We prefer just to have the dogs that have been broken in. They range from 1 year old through to 6 or 7 year old, so varying. Something to suit everyone, really. Someone's prepared to put a bit more work into a younger dog, well, there's good experienced dogs available as well. So.
And what sort of price do people pay for dogs like this?
Oh, look, they can range anywhere from $2,000 up to $10,000 or $12,000 for the real top end if there's a really good dog and someone here prepared to pay that sort of money. So, But yeah, I think the last couple of years we've averaged around that six odd thousand.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is, yep. But as I say, there's not people training dogs today, so people are prepared to step up and pay for a good, well-trained dog.
And how will people know about a dog's potential?
Well, we give them a display out here. We're working with the sheep. The heading dogs get out and they bring a few sheep out for them to work with. They can show what sort of command they're under. And then the Hunter-Wayne can do the same, all plus also they can give a bit of a demonstration in the yard here. So there's quite a few regular vendors. We always get a few young guys training a few dogs up to sell, but then there's some regular guys that have been selling here for a long time, yeah.
Yes. How long will the auction go on for?
I'd say approximately 2 to 2.5 hours. We give each dog about a 2 minute time to do its thing.
I'm Michael Miller from Darfield. I'm selling two dogs because I'm cutting down on my farming. I'm getting too old to chase sheep. And so I've got two genuine dogs to sell here today. Queen is 3 year old. And Speck is 3.5. Yes.
And what sort of dogs are they?
They're both heading dogs. That's one here. That's Queen, black and white one.
And she's sitting down, quite relaxed.
Yes, it is.
Wondering what's happening.
Yeah, it is.
What's so special about your dogs?
Oh, I think they're good-natured and they work for anyone. They're good paddock dogs. They're well broken in. And it'll take about 2 months, really, before they, work for them properly. Yeah, some dogs change over quicker than others. Yes. I think they should sell fairly well.
Do you make sure that they go to a good home?
Most people who buy them here, they pay good money, they'll look after them. Usually no, most people who buy them.
Michael, how long have you been coming here to this sale?
I've been coming here for about 52 years.
Buying and selling?
Yeah, selling mainly, always selling, yes. I've got young ones coming on, and I sell those, the ones that are surplus those, pass them on. And it's always been a good sale.
Yes.
There's some good dogs here today. Yeah, 23 heading dogs and 11 Hunter-Wayne. Years ago, there used to be 100 dogs here.
Why are there so many less now?
Oh, all dairy farms around here now. Yeah, the sheep numbers are down.
And tell me about your farm.
When I was farming up at Peak Hill, Lake Coleridge, high country place. My son's up there now, he runs it now. And I'm on a small place at Darfield.
Have you still got some sheep?
I've only a few sheep now.
Yeah, but you still have that passion for
That's
farming?
Right, yeah, still have that. Yeah, I'm only selling these dogs, so I'm starting to slow down.
Hello.
I'm Dave Closton, and I'm just here because I've sort of do a bit of dog trialling and have got a fairly good interest in sheep dogs. So just here to see, there's a few dogs here of various bloodlines that I sort of follow and just see how they go. And I don't know, if there's one that really takes my eye, I might consider putting a bit in. So there's about eight I've got in the catalogue that I've just put a wee star behind to see how they go on the day.
Yes, and where do you farm?
I've just got a lifestyle block, so I'm actually a banker that works for BNZ, and I do, you know, dog trialling's my hobby, and I've always sort of been mucking around with dogs. I'm an ex-musterer and all that sort of stuff, so yeah, basically just a lifestyler with almost as many dogs as sheep.
And so how much are you prepared to pay?
Oh, I wouldn't. There's only a couple of young dogs here. I wouldn't be going much more than $4,000, probably. But I mean, that's, you know, there's the reality is the amount of work that you put on a dog. It's you know, they're worth every bit of that. And I suspect the prices will go all right because there's not a huge gallery of dogs, and there's probably more buyers than sellers. So it'll be interesting to see how they go.
What do you look for in a dog?
Basically, temperament's number one. Nice, steady dog that's just, you know, fairly relaxed. Good dark eye. Just good conformation, good breeding. And it really comes down to, you know, they might look good against the fence, but it's what they do out in the pen that makes the difference. Yeah.
And talking about out in the pen, it looks like the auction is just about to start.
Yeah. Yep. So I might do a runner and yeah, no, all the best.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
Good on you.
Most of you know the drill here, ladies and gentlemen. We sell on the catalogue order. There is a supplementary page for those of you who haven't got it, and there's one extra dog on that you won't have at all, which I'll announce at the end. So I think there's about 46 dogs here in total, okay? 28 is withdrawn. Well, Graham's come down with COVID, and lot 43 has been withdrawn due to the bitch coming on heat, okay? And all you that were very concerned about it and rang me, the pub is open from 12 o'clock today. So lot one, ladies and gentlemen, is Alan Ferry's entry from Oxford. We've got Boy, who's a 2.5-year-old tri-coloured heading dog, medium-eyed, whistle commands, tight pulling and clean working. A good nature, ladies and gentlemen. So there's Boy just heading out now.
My name's Sue Rucastle and I'm from Dovedale in the Nelson area, and I'm looking for a trained heading dog. I have got a Huntaway at the moment, so, and she's getting too old.
Are there any dogs here that have caught your eye?
Yes. Yeah, there's about three that I would like to see work on stock. I'm aware of how much the top ones go for, but I don't need a top dog. I want a dog that will just fit in with our lifestyle.
Yes, yes. And if you do buy one today, will you take it home?
Yes, definitely, yes.
How do people pay for their dogs?
We're not a member of Pine Gull Guinness, so we'll pay cash.
If you purchase a dog, Dave, just meet the vendor at the gate there, and we'll give you an opportunity to get the commands and all that sort of stuff.
David Willens, Westpac Agribusiness. We're here doing the barbecue for the Mayfield dog sale.
Are you raising money for anyone?
Mayfield School. We're supporting the local school to get kids away on camp this year. And so just sausages, bacon sammies, hot soup, hot coffee. Come over and I'll shout you one if you want.
Thank you very much. It's a chilly morning, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's always way middle of July. Feels like middle of winter. Yes. Frost with cloud cover on top. And it makes it pretty brutal. But anyway, it's all good. Everyone's here to find a good dog. So,
how often do you come to sales like this?
Reasonably frequently, yeah. So from a Westpac point of view, it's something we can do to help the community. Fundraising for schools, getting out in rural schools. It's really important, big part of our area. Are all rurally based clients, and so it's just a little thing we can do.
And from a banking point of view, what is the mood amongst farmers?
Optimistic. So we've got record prices for red meat, we've got record prices for dairy, we've got a strong outlook, we've got a low currency. Clearly there's plenty of challenges with incoming regulation, but look, the farming industry is up for it, and there's some really good positive changes out there. So there's a lot of people making a lot of difference on the ground on how they're running their farms and minimising their environmental impact. You know, we support that 100%, and it's just good to see the industry rising to the challenges, really.
Yes, and I guess that buoyancy could well impact on today's sale.
Yeah, look, it could do. We expect to see some pretty strong sales. I know it was strong last year, and red meat prices have lifted again. You think about the value of a dog to a farming business.
Huge.
Saves a labour unit, and in some cases two, and in this environment when labour's really hard to get, hard to find good people, the value of a dog is really worthwhile.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, there we go. That's Boy, the 2.5-year-old tricolour dog there, medium eye. Whistle commands, ladies and gentlemen. Time to make close to what, 3,000 goes there? 3,000 somewhere, come on, 2.5, surely, come on. I've got 1,500, 1,500, 1,500, 1,500, 1,500, 2,000, 2,000, 2,2, on Bruce's call, 2,002. Out you go, 2,200. We're going to sell him, ladies and gentlemen. He's here for sale, 2,500. Victor's call. How's your man, Bruce? At 2,005. Ha ha! At 2,500. Bidding quick. All over. Out you go. 2,500. Buys them. 2,500.
I'm Brian Keenan. I'm here to sell a young heading dog, 40 months old. He doesn't fit in my team very well. He's pretty keen.
Yes.
And I think he thinks he's got five names. Every time I try and work another dog, he does it.
Yeah. How many dogs have you got in total?
Seven. Yeah. If I didn't have any dogs, I'd stop farming. They're more important than me, really.
What's he called?
Clyde.
And what are you hoping to get for Clyde today?
3,000 or 4,000, I guess. I just hope he gets a good home, really, and somebody that appreciates him. You know, he's got the work for him. He just needs the work, really.
How long will a dog like Clyde be able to work on a farm?
If he's on sort of medium country, and he'd get 10 years.
Right, lot 7 coming in there, ladies and gentlemen. Scott Hussey's entry. We've got Bert, who's a 2-year-old heading dog, black and white, well-bred heading dog, ladies and gentlemen. He's hard running and strong pulling. Will make a good work dog. Just needs an experienced hand and a bit more work, ladies and gentlemen. Good distance with him.
Greg Metherall, and I'm from North Otago, Courier.
Tell me about your farm.
We're a hill country place, 3,000 hectares of all hills, so the dogs get plenty of hill experience, so and plenty of distance.
And you've just sold your dog?
Yep. She's very honest, very kind, very easy to dog to work, even though she's got quite a lot of noise and that. The only reason I'm selling her is I just don't see that she's got enough trial potential for what I want her for. But she's a genuine dog.
Mm. Are you happy with the price you got?
I would have expected a bit more for a quality dog like that. 5,000, but like she's only 2.5. She's got, 6 or 7 years in front of her, so it makes her a pretty cheap dog.
Right, this is Morris Hackman's entry, ladies and gentlemen. Morris has been a great supporter of the side here over the years. This 3.5-year-old runaway bitch, she's fully broken in. Right, we'll take him out in the paddock now.
PGG writes an auctioneer, Greg Cook. Ending that story from the 64th Ashburton Working Dog Sale that was held at the Mayfield A&P Showgrounds last week. To see some photos Cosmo took on the day, go to the Country Life page on the RNZ website.
I'm Robin Green, I live at Tihoro Beach, and I have to say that Country Life is one of my favourite programmes. Country Life on RNZ National.
It's late autumn, and we're taking you now to meet a woman who admits a serious addiction. Natalie Tolchard loves her dahlias. She and her husband Zoltan took on this 3/4-hectare plot of land near Clive and Hawke's Bay 4 years ago. They started off with sheep, then thought about trees, and then they hit on the idea of growing dahlias for the cut flower market. And now Natalie has hundreds of varieties.
I mean, look at it. It's just, it has reverse petals, so the petals go towards the back. They bend backwards, so it's an orange dahlia. And this one also is a new one for me, so it doesn't have a name on it yet. But it grows outward like a normal decorative wood, but then the petals start reversing backwards on itself and you get that arcing at the back.
It's a bit of a show-off dahlia, isn't it?
It's my kind of dahlia.
You cut them long.
Mm-hmm. It's four vases, so I cut them at least 30 centimetres. A lot of them are the focal flower that you would use in your arrangement. So you get a lot also that are sitting at the back, you know, helping to support the bouquet. But dahlias generally are the stars in anything you do. Yeah, I can't imagine how they ever went out of fashion.
They're sort of got an image a little bit of being, no offence to grannies, but a granny's flower.
Oh, they do. And I think they actually used to be referred to as a poor man's rose, I think, or something like that. They do. A lot of people at the farmers' markets will say, oh, my grandmother used to grow them. And I don't know that there are many of us who don't know someone that grew them. My grandmother grew them. Although I don't really remember them that well, except for the smell turned me off. It doesn't do that now as an adult, but as a child I just like, oh, they don't smell very nice. The stem is where the smell is.
Oh, yeah, I can smell that.
I think herbaceous. To my nose it was very, very strong.
They make up for it with the colour and the look.
Yeah, absolutely. And the form. So many forms. You've got cactuses.
The cactuses are the spikier ones.
The spiky looking, spidery ones. And then you've got decorative that we've just talked about, the orange one. And then you have the ball varieties and palms and water lilies. There are so many. I can't think of any other flower that has that range of form and colour. And we've got new ones coming through all the time with breeders that do a lot of crossbreeding with seed and,
You wouldn't know it, but Natalie is fairly new to the business and passion of dahlia growing. But she did spend more than a year researching and doing the numbers. She trained as a teacher, worked in health and safety, even driven a digger.
Yeah, I like to be in the garden.
Is this a retirement job for you?
No, there's nothing about this job that says retirement. It is full on, and when I'm in this season, I actually am working constantly, and that includes at night when I go inside and I actually manage to have a shower and eat. I'll then turn on the computer and start that side of the work. So it's a long time. However, you know, you've got to find all these things out. I think part of being in business is knowing all of the ins and outs of your business and knowing what it takes, how many hours it takes to do the work, so that if you do in the future make enough money to employ people, you know what their tasks are and the processes. So
you already employ one person?
I do.
Are you going to be employing more?
I will be, definitely.
So it's a worthwhile business for
you? It is, but it has to make money as well. So this year's focus is on making finished products. So right now I've completed a calendar. I've also got workshops coming up in September, which are selling out, and I have three of those. And it's looking like I might need a couple more. So my September month is actually going to be full. So
you also do tours. You have
I do.
People coming to look at the dahlias?
Yes, we had two large groups of 30 people. Yeah, the ladies do tend to swoon when they go down the rows. They get told where they can and cannot place their feet, such as in my weedy garden beds. And as long as they stay away from those areas, they're fine. But they stand in groups and they just swoon. I do it myself privately.
You also say this is a wonderful place for mental health.
Oh, it is. People that come in, they just get lost. They're in the present moment. You know, they're focusing on what they are standing in front of. A lot of times we have a lot of chit-chat going on in our heads, and flowers take you away from that, and they keep you rooted in the now. So I think for mental health, that's got to be the best thing.
I'm here near the end of the dahlia season, and the blooms are on their last legs. Some of them are big, fat and plumpy, and others small and dainty. How many varieties have you got growing here,
so
Natalie?
We've got around 130 varieties.
In this one paddock?
In this one paddock. We're 7,000 square metres, and we only occupy 4 dahlias, the last maybe half of that, so 3.5 is what I'd use for my business activity. Well, we have these 16 metres. I've got 230 buckets as well at the back, which also house new dahlias that come in. So I segregate them out, and they've come from sources that I don't know.
So is there a risk of disease?
There is. You do get leaf gall and you get crown gall.
So and that damages the bloom, does it?
It does, so it will actually compromise how much bloom you get off a tuber. So they're in there, just waiting until the season ends, and then I can check to see whether they've been compromised. And then they will find themselves in the 16-metre beds where I'm going to take out certain ones that I don't think are good. And by that I mean they may not be good for as a cut flower, or they may be too large, and people just, while they like large flowers, they just wouldn't do well in a vase, and they look good as a plant, a garden plant, as opposed to a cut flower, and I'm about cut flowers at the moment.
You have to have a good eye, and I suppose you're always critically looking over these flowers to see which ones are going to be good for you.
Yeah, that's a good observation. It definitely is how I work. During the season I'll be picking for the markets, and it's a good indicator about what people like, the farmers markets, what they actually like as a cut flower. Although you get some ladies that just love the big ones. They won't have anything but the big ones. However, florists want a certain other type of flower. So there are long stems they prefer. They prefer slightly ball-shaped ones, which keep longer than other larger blousy flowers, like the Winds Moonlight Sonata over there.
Those are the salmon pink ones, which have
salmon pink, yeah.
And they're all sort of, as you say, blousy.
They're
so
blousy,
droopy, and very sort of florid, almost, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And as you can see on the plant right now, they're falling over. The weight of the head of the flower is so large that the stem can't hold it up. And ladies like that. There's a mathematical terminology called the Fibonacci sequence, where you have repeating patterns and tessellations and things like that. And dahlias, they're a prime example of how it works in nature. They have repeating patterns all around.
Contributes to how perfect it looks,
doesn't it? It does, especially with an aphid.
Oh, yes.
That time of the year.
What do you do about the pests?
So they just need a spray. I don't do a lot of spraying, so I use a lot of natural where I can try to source it. If you're in a home garden, I would just use hot water in a spray bottle with dishwashing liquid, spray the undersides of the leaves as well as the tops, and give them a squirt with a hose. And I think that's the easiest way to get rid of it.
But you do have a lot of bees.
I have a load of bees and bumbles. I love them, and we have a lot of photos of them. And you sometimes get carried away by the wildlife. Also, my cats and dog come out, and they're all in the garden beds, as well as the chickens, and they're helpful, though. The chickens are very helpful. They just take all of any other pests that we might have.
Natalie also sells the dahlia tubers, so we're just going into the shed to see where she divides and stores them.
Oh, wow.
We're looking at a table full of tubers, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Masses and masses of them.
In bread crates. So I have a supplier who gives me bread crates that are just a little bit broken, or there's something wrong with them, or they're non-compliant and can't be held in the supermarket. And so I get them and then I reuse them. Within the dahlia world, seeds won't give you the true form of the parent that you took it from. You'll get a myriad of other things that'll pop up, so it's very potluck. However, if you were to take cuttings, or if you were to plant a tuber, they will give you the true to form of the parent that you took it from.
And of course you can split the tubers and then gain more.
You certainly can.
At what stage of the growth of the plant do you do that?
So as soon as the season is finished, we get the first frosts again. Then we can lift them. If you wanted, you can leave them in the ground if your climate and your area and your soil actually allows for them to be left in the ground.
When do you do the splitting?
So the splitting I would do at the end of autumn, or when the first frost comes, and I'm taking all of those tubers out of the garden. that I don't want. Then I would split them up into maybe sets of four, depending on whether I think there are eyes. It's a bit hard in autumn to decide whether there are eyes. So on the tuba, so you have a dahlia is comprised or makes up is made up of a tuba, a neck, and a crown, a piece of crown. And on the crown you have what are called eyes, and the eyes are where you get the stems that produce the flowers for you. So when we lift them at this time of the year, sometimes you can't see the eyes on some varieties, so they're better to be left as a clump. And then in the September, around September, you'll start seeing them form. They'll be forming because the weather is starting to get warmer, and they'll start to form. And that's when you can probably divide them into smaller pieces or smaller clumps.
And then transplant them into different beds.
That's right. We also call them chicken legs. So if you wanted to go quite hard on your separating, you would cut them into either clumps or chicken legs.
Why are they called chicken legs?
They look like a drumstick. That's what
makes sense.
Yeah. If I take that off, where was it? That was attached to the.
You've got to have good eyesight for this.
You do.
Because you do. That's quite hard to see.
It is, and you get used to it. You do get used to what they look like, but. That's a possible eye, and that would be it on that tuba, but that's viable and that's for sale.
Natalie, how did you learn all this stuff?
I think it's like anything. If you really want to know, you source the information. I guess I'm just a researcher born. I don't know, but...
Did you spend a lot of time beforehand? How long?
A year to 2 years, but I was sold on the idea in the beginning, mainly because they were just so beautiful and there was a possibility that I could make a return off it. And so when I did some numbers on that, I could see there was quite a bit of money to be made in the first year, and that was really what... And then I allowed myself to become addicted, and now I have to actually make money to satisfy my addiction. That's exactly how it has turned out. And the worst part about it is I belong to a wonderful Facebook group called New Zealand Dahlia Growers, and they're just as bad as I am. And there's a lot of people, and wonderful people, wonderful resource for anyone on your station network listening that would like to actually learn about dahlias.
The chooks are still with us as we head back out to what used to be just a scrappy bit of land, and the dahlias, even this late in the season, are still a feast for the eyes.
Such a beautiful flower. Sorry. I love my job. I'm sorry, I get lost in it.
And Natalie's not the only one.
We've got a lot of people in New Zealand who are bringing them in from overseas, so they're importing them from America or from England or wherever they can, and thank goodness MPI haven't jumped on board and said, no, you can't bring those in.
So there is a trend and there is a fashion, there is a desire for dahlias.
Oh my gosh, is there something? It's chronic. If we were in a store, say like Black Friday, and you know how the customers all barge and try and get to the products before the others, that's what it would be like, only it's online. And we right now, as opposed to 3 years ago, I have to work out a strategy to buy online now because it's that hard.
They get snapped up.
It's taken my husband about a year to get used to it, but I gave him a task. I needed him to buy into my dream, so I gave him a task to purchase last year, and I don't know if I did the right thing. A year, $3,000 later, I have another 230 dahlias.
Is he going to help you plant them?
He actually knows all he knows. He helps me plant. He helps me do a lot of stuff. So he bought in really badly. And we're both addicted now.
What about the future, Natalie? What's going to happen in future with the business?
Yeah, so we only had a 7 to 10 year plan, and it's looking like we're staying. So we were originally
contemplating getting the house to a stage where it was going to be saleable and the backyard, and we love what we're doing. So we've actually purchased a bus, which is going to be used as a bus in the dahlias, and you can come and stay at some stage. However, that's a project for maybe in another 2 years. Sleep with the dahlias.
Sleep with the dahlias. What a beautiful
yeah,
thought.
I thought so. I think it would be. Yeah.
Imagine waking up and seeing that sea of colour.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I could do that.
Natalie Tolshard at her dahlia farm near Clive in Hawke's Bay. She's also looking at a side hustle in ranunculus and tamarillos. If you know a farmer or grower with a passion like Natalie's, do let us know. We'd love to meet them.
And just before we go, a quick correction to a comment made a couple of weeks ago in our item about native trees and their role in New Zealand for biodiversity and carbon sequestration. Our guest said it would be good if pest control were a tax-deductible expense for landowners. Well, it is. Thanks to a couple of listeners for picking up on that.
Well, that's it from me here on the banks of the Tongariro River. Kia mahana. Stay warm and dry.
Have a jolly good weekend. Go the All Blacks. Bye now.